Coming up on this week's book show, Changrai Li's new novel, My Year Abroad, is the story about a young American life transformed by an unusual Asian adventure and about the human capacities for pleasure, pain, and connection. Changrai Li on this week's book show. Welcome to the Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Changrai Li's new novel, My Year Abroad, is the story about a young American life transformed by an unusual Asian adventure and about the human capacities for pleasure, pain, and connection. At the heart of the novel is Tiller, an unassuming college student whose ordinary life is turned upside down when he embarks on a wild trip around the globe with a charismatic Chinese-American businessman named Pong. A year later, he finds himself living with an older woman and her son and quickly slips from one life to another as he processes all he's experienced. Told in alternating storylines, Tiller's tale weaves back and forth between his outlandish, memorable year with Pong and the domestic adulthood that replaces it. Changrai Li's work includes Native Speaker, On Such a Full Sea, and The Surrendered, a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. Again, the new book is My Year Abroad, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Changrai Li to this week's book show. Thank you very much for being with us. What a delight to have you on the program.
Pleased to be here, Joe.
What brought you to want to write about a young man, a 20-year-old man who is trying to figure things out?
Well, I'd originally felt as if I was going to write a book about a middle-aged guy, but like myself. But I decided pretty early on that that kind of character wasn't going to satisfy all the questions that I had. And I guess there were questions about how one enters the world, how one enters his life, you know, both as a person and then as an adult, someone with responsibility. And it's because instead of thinking about myself now, of course, I'm full of responsibilities, established in a job. I was curious, looking back at my own life, about the things I was considering when I was younger, you know, at that age around 20, kind of in the threshold between someone in childhood and someone whose responsibilities are beginning to dawn on him. Because I thought that was a pretty fraught, kind of exciting, kind of anxious time, and I thought that would be a great way to propose someone who is just about to embark on something new.
This embarking on something new, as I mentioned in the introduction, told in alternating storylines about this year with Pong, who we'll get into, we'll introduce him into the conversation in a moment, and the adulthood that comes after that. But this idea of my year abroad, which happens, but certainly not in the way that Tiller was expecting it to happen.
No, not at all. You know, the setup, of course, is that he meets this businessman, Pong, and of course he's going to be introduced to the ways of, you know, commerce, the typical stuff, going on business, travel, and meeting associates. But of course I wanted to take him on a journey that would be a little bit more, or a lot more intense, a lot stranger, a lot more eye-opening, as it were. And so what I sought to do from the very beginning was to, of course, put him on this adventure, but to make the adventure ever strange, ever complicating, so that He would, of course, not just focus on business, which is the stated objective, but of course, be forced to think about the deeper questions about the nature of pretty much everything, the nature of the body, the nature of desire, the nature of want, and so this book is so much about him going out in the world and maybe taking a taste of it, but also, as it turns, the world in some ways literally taking a taste of him.
He seems like a nice kid.
Well, he is a nice kid, and also Pong is a nice fellow. And one of the things that I kind of discovered in the writing of this book is that I didn't really want to have quote unquote, heavies, evil characters. Now there are people in the book who do dark things, but I guess my sense of this realm that I was creating was that it was filled with people doing their best, trying their best given their circumstances, and maybe subject at their worst to certain desires, obsessions, fascinations that were maybe a little unhealthy, but certainly still in the spirit of, I suppose, ambition for not just business success, but ambition for a certain level or a certain attainment of living. That was joyous and glorious. Of course, we all fail in that, and I think this book tries to outline all those possibilities.
Talk a little bit about Tiller's upbringing. He has an absent mother and a father who he has a relationship with, but it is at times strained and certainly distant when it is there. And then how that void is filled in with Pong and how these two meet and why this man in his position takes Tiller under his wing in the first place.
Yes, Tiller definitely has this big emotional void in his life. He actually, even though he has a dad, his mother has disappeared long ago in his youth. And as you mentioned, their relationship is cordial, even loving, but distant and detached. And I think Tiller feels a little bit like an orphan. He even calls himself that during the course of the book. I think he feels orphaned by the world too. He's a latchkey kid. Often alone. He sometimes makes toast in the house just to pretend that someone else is there making toast. And he's looking for everything. He's looking for a mentor. He's looking for a brother. He's looking for a guide, someone who will take him up and see something in him, which Pong does. And I think this is the thing that appeals so much to him about this fellow Pong, who has so much energy and exuberance, who's so curious about the world, who doesn't feel as if the world is in any way out of his reach, business and otherwise. And Tiller, I think, as we all do, wishes that he had these capabilities, that he had these potential talents. And Pong, in turn, I think, does see something in Tiller, something that hasn't really emerged yet in terms of his character and capabilities, and draws them out. And what we find in the course of the novel is that Tiller indeed does have some real skills and gifts that were, heretofore, just not engaged. And this is something that Tiller, of course, loves, but of course, it leads him down certain paths that become a little dangerous.
You mentioned the toast a moment ago, and it's a part of the book where you're writing about his loneliness and how he tries to combat that loneliness. And the toast is one way. Another way is they have three toilets in the house, and he'll pee in each one of them just so it seems like there's people there in the house. And he plays music. Music is a large part of the book, as is food. That loneliness is so palpable in this novel with many of the characters.
Like Tiller, they have their own trajectories, but they've each of them in their own ways have found themselves a bit marooned by circumstance, either family, the culture, just the nature of personal history. And that's something I think that is a through line throughout the book, about the need for and desire for in all of us for communion, often in the form of family, which is why Tiller ends up with this young mother and her young son in the other half of the book. But this idea that that we do need these connections, and without them, you know, we starve. And this is a book about, you know, a state of chronic emotional, you know, craving that Tiller is desperately trying to fill, as well as all the other characters in the novel.
Cheng Ray Lee is our guest. The name of the new novel is My Year Abroad. It is published by Riverhead Books. You write, there are things you have seen that you wish you hadn't, because no matter what you do, they will never be erased. We're engineered with an ever-ready PTSD, maybe because surviving usually means suffering. But after a while, if it's not totally crushing, you can't help but be the tiniest bit thankful for certain shocking lingerings, especially in the leaner, emptier moments, which can always be filled by their undying glow. No warmth, but at least some light. That seems to be something that you evoke throughout the novel, of those feelings of that ever-ready PTSD.
Well, I think this book is interested in the prospect of what a body can, and I'm not talking about a mind only, I'm talking about a mind and body experience. This is a book that's about the viscera, I think, in some ways, you know, how we engage with the world. Of course, we're, you know, what separates us from everything else is the capacities of our brains, our cerebral lives. But as someone once said, the body is the one that recalls. The body is what knows first. You know, that in any situation, and I think we all know this, you know, our physical selves understand the moment before our mental selves do. Whether that's through smell, through just feeling, a kind of intuition, and of course, all that stuff can be, you know, can be the appreciation of beauty and majesty and soulfulness, but it can also be, of course, the, you know, the forced reckoning with something much darker, pain, real anguish. And that's what, you know, I wanted to put Tiller through this novel, that he was going to go out into the world, but that it was going to be an adventure that was, you know, peppered with a lot of serious, intensive experience, and right down to the nerve cells. And that, that after that, you know, after those nerve cells have been, you know, frazzled and maybe burnt out, there's a certain kind of opening, I think. And I think we've all experienced that in our lives after great trauma or after great sadness, even after great joy. You know, there's this emptiness and this new plane that makes everything a little bit clearer and different.
I think it's important to point out that at several times in the novel, you remind us, and Tiller reminds us, that even though there are these longings and there are these wants and there are these deprivations, that he is privileged, that he comes to this with the understanding that he is a privileged kid.
Absolutely. He grows up in a very privileged American suburb, based upon Princeton, New Jersey, which if you've ever been there, is a classic, you know, kind of ivy covered town. And although he's not very wealthy, he doesn't come, he's wealthy enough to have a safety net and a secure, comfortable life. And he's very aware of his position. And one of the things I wanted to put him through in his travels was to kind of turn around, turn the tables on him in terms of, you know, the typical kind of journey where, you know, a certain privileged young man would go abroad, experience some newness and exoticism and thereby gain some wisdom about the world and his life. But of course, that story is from the point of view of the colonizer, the privileged, the person who can always leave. And for Tiller, I wanted him to actually be stuck there, enslaved to the moment, literally and figuratively, and be forced to reckon with things that maybe his predecessors in history and literature did not.
Your merging of an amazing vocabulary and a slacker kid who's smoking weed out in the porch is amazing. Like, here's an example of you writing. I guess I wasn't concentrating, not because I didn't want to help, but because I was mostly wondering why this whitish dude spoke such mashed up English. In fact, I was enjoying the trip and jaunt of his speech, how it rolled along like a shined up jalopy, the bumpers and doors and hubcaps looking like they might fall off any second, the engine about to go kaboom, but the whole funny contraption of it staying put and clattering forth and conveying us down the road. How long did it take you to get really comfortable in writing in that voice?
You know what, Joe? It actually came to me quite quickly, and I don't know what that says about me. I mean, if you
Well,
know
I won't
this,
ask what you're doing on the porch.
well, I do live in California,
There you
but
go.
this voice is perhaps closest to my own personal voice, my in terms of my daily voice, not my writer's voice, not my college professor's voice, not my. You know, not my work voice, as it were, but my day-to-day rhythm, which is definitely and deeply informed by the fact that my daughters are that age. Of course, I'm a college professor, so all of my students, you know, from the beginning of my career 25 years ago, have always been around 20 years old. I continue to get older, of course. They stay the same age. And as a writer, you know, I'm attentive to, and particularly attentive to language and the ways in which people express themselves. And I thought very early on that I would just, you know, access all the things that I had learned over the years, hearing now, sources that are both, you know, academic, philosophical, intellectual, but also pop cultural, you know, social media, everything, and just let the palette be very wide for me so that I could just dab on everything I wanted. And I think I first found that with the first paragraph of the novel, which includes the word gunge three times,
Yes.
which is not a word that, you know, I use very often
Yeah.
in my work, but felt right.
Well, refers to his genitals a lot as his junk.
Yep.
There's a lot of references to people, to smell, and to both of the classes that he is in and the upper class of the town he's living in, which are both affectionate and searing at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, he's, as you say, he's a smart kid. And maybe because he's been probably a little passive and thinking himself to be ineffectual, he just lives this mental life where he can observe and think about all the things that he's experienced even before he goes off on his crazy adventure with Pong. So he's definitely someone who's in the world, just not touching it yet. And I like that balance, before, you know, setting him off on his journey.
We have been talking about the relationship between Tiller and Pong, but I also want to get, as you say, to the other half of the book, which is about the relationship with Val and her son, Vige. Tiller's 20. She, Val, is older, much older, and old enough to have an 8-year-old son. And he is taking over, really, Tiller is taking over this father role in many ways and is trying to keep this family unit together, which is not the typical place a 20-year-old finds themselves.
No, and it's absolutely probably not what he would have agreed to had he known that that was going to be. I mean, but of course, you know, in this part of the story, and even though it's half the, you know, it's the present time of the story, I tell these two stories simultaneously. I wanted him to be in a different spot, in a place where there was a lot more stasis, where it seemed as if it was controlled, but that there is still a fraughtness and there's a sense of danger, although the danger is not exogenous, but something that comes from within. And I wanted him to face up to the idea that he had responsibilities, for those he loved. And maybe and also he's coming to the idea that he does in fact love these people, which is I think of and taking a stand in that is something that we all do in the course of growing up. It's like, oh my goodness, these are folks, and this is a moment in which I have to stand and deliver. I can't run away. I can't make irony of it. I can't just retire. Go out on the porch and smoke. I have to do something here. And I was curious to see how, given his experiences out in the world with Pong, how those things would begin to express themselves and be embodied.
Well, and that is important because the relationship that he has with Pong and what goes on there happens prior to the relationship with Val and her son. But at no time, at least to my recollection in my reading of the novel, there's no time that he really complains about it. That there are times where he needs a breath, he needs to go out, he needs to clear his head. But there's no time that he's complaining about the position that he's in.
No, and I don't think he complains either, that much in Pong's world either. He's someone that I guess I would call truly open and vulnerable. Invulnerable in the sense that he's open to all the feelings and emotions and kinds of hardships that come upon him. And I don't know why he's that way, but that's I think part of his just natural optimism. But of course, when you're that vulnerable, when you're that open, and when you're taking on everything, things start to add up. And I do think he feels, deeply burdened and disturbed by it. The question is what he's going to do. And I was interested in that. And I think it was thinking me, it was my thinking back to my 20s, when I did also feel very burdened by circumstance in my family and the kinds of things that I desperately wanted to do, which was just escape. And maybe this is a novel ultimately about not escaping. Whereas, so many of my stories are about people who are just trying to do that the whole time. And I guess in this novel, I wanted to see what someone would do when they just realized that they couldn't.
There are times in the world, in Pong's world, where Tiller is welcome to this buffet of debauchery and does quite well. Then there is also a part of that world that is literally and figuratively backbreaking. This young man realizes that with these great things that are odd, but he is experiencing and very open to, you used the word open a moment ago, but just as open to these experiences that in some ways could be described as pure torture.
Yeah, and that's the nature of openness, right? It can also be a wound, a potential wound. And I guess if Tiller is anything, I think he's an Epicurean, not someone who's interested in the pop cultural sense of Epicureanism, but someone who's, living in his body, understanding that there's light and dark, there's pain and pleasure. That this constant alternation between and across that spectrum of experience is available to him, and that he's necessarily subject to. And that's a certain kind of wisdom that surprised me when I started, really getting into his character, but that I was fascinated by, particularly since he was a younger fellow. And I think psychically it led me to a lot of interesting then, actions and plot points that could get quite fantastical at some points, but I felt like if anyone, Tiller could somehow process them. He could somehow order them in a way that made some kind of, at least, I don't know, bodily sense, and that he could come out of whole at some point.
You use the word Epicurean, but food is very much a part of this. Food flavors, whether it be the concoctions that Pong is working on. This starts off with, in the meeting of Pong, with the tasting of frozen yogurt, and then in the life with Val and Veej, Veej becomes a child local celebrity chef, if you will. And
child prodigy.
Child prodigy is really knocking it out of the park, and strangers are showing up at the door to eat. That is too much of a thing for me to believe that it's not something that you intentionally said, okay, I want to really include this.
Well, to tell you the truth, food wasn't in the original conception of the book, but I learned pretty early on, and you discover this as you write a novel, what kinds of areas are going to, you know, push the buttons of the characters most and bring them out most, expose them most to us. And I realized, because this book is so much about, attempting to savor things about the world and all the things we've already talked about, I thought that just a great base of operations would be the fact and act of food and eating. You know, that's the daily, and it's also, of course, the daily activity and pleasure for most of us who are comfortable, decently comfortable in our lives, luckily so, you know, experience, right? I mean, it's the one thing that we, aside from going to the bathroom, we do on a regular basis that we can't help but attend to. And so I wanted that to be just one of the basic and constant rhythms of this novel and of his life. And of course, not to focus in the end about the actual taste of the food. And that's, I have some fun with that. But again, to go back to that, the notion of hunger, the notion of constantly wanting to try new things. And to see where, how that changes us and how it defines us.
You write toward the end of the novel, perhaps this got me obsessing about eventualities, such as how our time together might end. It's not like in a story. In stories, the endings are ones we can handle, even if they aren't so happy, because they let you linger, they let you go on, sustaining you with morsels of wonder and hope. I read that now and I realize, well, that's sort of how you left us in this novel.
You know, that's why we're storytelling creatures, aren't we? When you meet somebody, and now these days everyone says, tell me the story of your life, which is not exactly what happened in your life. it's not a moment by moment just factual tour of the life, right? It's the way that you create it. It's the way that that's constructed, which has some kind of sense to it, which has some kind, one hopes, meaning. The truth, of course, is that stories do end. And so what do we as people and storytellers do? Well, we try to leave ourselves this echo, right? And that echo of a life. And however you can gain that echo through storytelling about great acts, storytelling about redemptive moments, that's all we can do to fill it. And, that's the basic operation of all stories, I think, is to leave that echo.
Chang Rae Lee's new novel is My Year Abroad. It is published by Riverhead. Thank you so much for being with us. What a great pleasure having you on the program. And thank you for such a beautiful novel.
Thanks so much, Joe. It was really, really nice to talk.
We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening. For The Book Show, I'm Joe Donahue.